There we go.
Okay.
There we go. There's our dystopian cue recording in progress from the disembodied voice of the ether. Hey, everybody. This is Tom Lynn, and today I am joined by a teacher of mine, the distinguished Arthur Dewey. Last time we talked with David Cayley about lots of things. One thing we talked about was how even at this far edge of the secular modern, ours is a society almost inescapably Christian in its underpinnings and its influences, for better or for worse. And in connection with that, as a sequel, we're going to take up an aspect of Christian narrative, which is really probably beyond a Well, I mean, it's it would be difficult to exaggerate its significance. And that is the question of the death of Jesus. And Dr. Dewey, Arthur Dewey, has written a book not so long ago, how the death of Jesus was re remembered inventing the passion. And it's really about more than just the tragic death of someone. About 2 millennia past. It's about more than that, but I'm going to restrain myself and turn it over to Dr. Dewey, because he can probably start by talking about how the narrative around the death of Jesus emerged, which in many respects I think is going to be surprising for the predominance of us. Maybe not. It's surprising to me, but I don't know. I guess I'll turn it over to you there.
Okay, thanks, Tom. I appreciate what you said. Actually, it was a surprise to me too. Let me begin by showing the audience some images and see if this will work. And it's not. Let's try this again. This feeling. Let's see, try it one more time. There we are.
All right,
There we go.
now we're back into it.
Yes. The delights of the machine. Let's see if I can move this so I can get, yeah, here we go. One, two, slideshow. Current slide. Okay. All right. My journey into the question of the death of Jesus had a number of entrances, one of which was the slow realization that when you look for the death of Jesus in images in the of the period, you don't find them. And if the death of Jesus is so important, if you look at the canonical gospels, every gospel has a narrative about the death of Jesus. Paul talks about the death of Jesus. Why is it the case that when you look at early art coming out of the Jesus movement, the death of Jesus is not there? In fact, you get other, for example, this the figure of Jonah is very prominent, but not Jesus dying on a cross. Now, let me show you the earliest possible image, and this is a it's a Graffito found in the catacombs of Rome. Actually, it's not in the Christian catacombs. It's in a room which was relatively secular, and somebody had scribbled this. And you can see that the Greek here is hardly that of a skilled writer. And I'm going to sh so the one on the left is the one that it looks like. I'm going to give you another version of it, and also the Greek and the English. And this is a very curious thing. First of all, you have a figure, a cruciform figure, with what appears to be an ass's head. And it reads Alexamenos, which is the name of this fellow to the left with his raised arm, worships his God. So the God is this cruciform figure. And many people Consider that this is a taunt. This is an insult to the Jesus followers, and it could very well be. There is another possibility, and it sort of dovetails with the emergence of the Jesus movement out of Judaism, and that is about 300 years before the time of Jesus. There was an Egyptian by the name of Manetho who had a few things to say about Jews, and he characterized the worship of Jews as being incredibly stupid. And why? Because, number one, they wouldn't allow foreigners to get near the altar. They would keep them away. Why would they do that? Well, it was not only because of holiness and protection, but it had to do with the God they were worshiping. And he said, if you walked into the Holy of Holies, where the high priest goes once a year, you would find an ass. The people worship an ass. So a number of scholars have suggested that this might actually be a critique of Jews. And indeed, the Jesus followers, even into the second century, many of them would consider themselves to be Jewish, so that it still could possibly be Jesus. We don't know. But in any event, this is the earliest, if it is an image of Jesus crucified, it is not the most happy one. And then we get this little amulet. This is third century, and it's much smaller than this. It's about one quarter the size, but it's increased so that you can see it. You can see the skull and the body on a cross. And it's hard to make out the letters, but the name Jesus is actually there. With other things, it's a magical amulet. Somebody had constructed this, carved it, to ward off evil, or to use in a curse, or in some sort of invocation. But that's all we have. That's it, folks. That we have not. We have to go to the 5th century, to about the year 405, 406, and we find this. This is an ivory casket. It's a box that would have enclosed precious objects or something like that. And on one portion of it, we find Jesus. And how do we know that? Because the scene shows the beloved disciple right here, and the mother here, and a centurion here. He would have had a raised spear. That's gone. And over here, from a totally other gospel, is Judas hanging around. So we have a very curious image of the death of Jesus. Now, it's interesting to look closely at the body of Jesus. A couple of things to note. One is that he doesn't seem to be in much pain. He seems to be almost stoic and maybe saying, I'm winning. Look to my right, to your left. I'm winning. So there's that possibility. The other thing to note is that if this were a realistic image of the crucified one, he would be totally naked. The height, he doesn't seem to be elevated very high, and that is actually typical of crucified people. They were not crucified very high. In fact, we have reports of dogs biting toes and birds pecking eyes out of the crucified victims. But this is it, and it might very well reflect a very interesting period. By the 4th century, the Jesus group has been officially accepted. And now we have this is 400. So Constantine is there a century before. And in 385, 87, Theodosius makes Christianity the religion of the empire. So this image of the death of Jesus curiously comes after the Christian religion has become the official religion of the empire. And it seems to be rather interesting that you have this image. Finally, we get an image of the death of Jesus only after they are in place as it were, the winners. And the reason I bring this up, let me go on to another one. We'll see. This is a Renaissance, an Italian Renaissance painter. And some people might have a more sense of familiarity with this, or at least identification with this. The crucified victims are higher. There's sort of prominence about them. There is certainly a concern for getting all the bones, the muscles, and the articulations of the body correct. Because so the anatomy becomes a very important thing in the Renaissance. But I just want to point out a few things. Number one, the soldiers are not wearing Roman uniforms. And these are Italian uniforms. And this is definitely not Jerusalem in the background. So the person is not being at all realistic. The crosses are much too high. But this is the death of Jesus done in the mind of a 15th century Renaissance painter. What I find very curious is that there is this step, and somebody's stepping out of something. Maybe they're even imagining a tomb right there on scene. And then we have a 17th century Spanish crucified Jesus. This is a very commonplace. You can still see images like this today. And again, the study of anatomy is there. Moreover, there would not be a loincloth. In reality, they would be naked, because the message that Rome is sending when they crucify is that we win, you lose. We win and we erase you. We reduce you to nothing. And to get a sense of that, let's look at something coming out of the 20th century. This is a postcard that was printed to celebrate the lynching of these two men. And if you can read, you'll see it was done in Merriam, Indiana, not even in the South, in 19, I think it's 1930. A man by the name John Allen was at a flea market one day and saw a photo like this and asked the man who was selling the photographs, "Do you have any more like this?" And the man said, "Yes, I have plenty." And that started Allen collecting these photographs. These are postcards. He found out why they were made. They were made during the Jim Crow era, and they were made to celebrate the lynching of these people. In this one, notice the teenagers here. This chap is even smiling. This man is pointing out that none of these people are in any agony or any sorrow over this. They were printed for two reasons. One was to celebrate the event, and they were passed among the people who, in fact, were involved in the lynching. But they also hoped that some African Americans would see these and get the message. So there was a double message to this card. Now, why do I bring this up? I bring this up because, in some ways, this image, in all its deplorable aspect, is really closer to first century crucifixion than any of the images from the Renaissance. It's important that you see that crucifixion was an attempt by Rome not only to dominate, but to make you nothing. It was an utter shaming of the person, so much so that relatives would not even want to remember you. It's what the Romans called the damnatio memoriae, the damning of memory. And when Romans damned memory, they would erase you. We see this in clubs, for example. If somebody belonged to a club and they failed to pay their dues, or they did something terrible in the club, their names would literally be scratched off the sign that had been made. And it was very important for people to be named, to give them a sense of who they were. What Rome was doing with crucifixion was to say to the public, "We are in charge, we win. You are nothing." Okay, so in some ways, I'll stop sharing it. In some ways, the reason why there was no image of the death of Jesus is that it was so traumatic, that the reality of crucifixion in the ancient world was too horrible to contemplate. Even the Romans who did it, Cicero enjoins people not even to think about it. They don't write about it. There are only two or three pieces of evidence where Roman writers begin to describe it. But it, for them, it's beneath them to think about the horrors. There's one horrible story about crucifixion. Two or three slaves in a Roman house assassinated the owner. And according to Roman law, if that happens, then all the slaves of the house are crucified. And there were 150 of them, including children and old people. And in the story that you read, they are literally brought out into public, and they walk to a place of execution. And the townspeople don't like it, but that's the way it is. Crucifixion was the punishment, particularly for rebels and for slaves. Anyone who raises a sandal against Rome could face crucifixion. And the Romans, because they were citizens, could not be crucified unless they did something so awful, or if the capturing general was so angry, they might be crucified. But usually Romans would not crucify Romans. It was a signal that Rome was in charge and you were ultimately nothing. So that's one reason why there are no images, but it just struck me as a very curious thing. And yet we have narratives in Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and in the Gospel of Peter we have it. We don't have it in the Gospel of Thomas. Go ahead.
Thank you. Positive question. Do we have Christian iconography prior or earlier than the, you know, which doesn't depict the crucifixion, but which depicts Jesus or something pertaining to the early Jesus movement?
Well, we do have images of Jesus as a healer. He has a wand, which is huge. It's much bigger than Harry Potter's wand. He's sort of tapping the raising of Lazarus, for example. We have him with the woman with the flow of blood. We have baptism scene. We also have other images. As I said earlier, the image of Jonah, which is a very curious one, but it's the whole story of Jonah being on the ship, being tossed into the sea, being swallowed by the great fish, being spit out, and then he's lying on the shore, and that's the end of the whole scenario. He's lying on the shore, but he looks like the figure of Endymion, the person who's sort of wrestling, and Endymion is a man who falls in love with the moon, but here he's wrestling, and it would seem to me that this indicates the sense of everlasting life and restfulness. There's also the three young men in the fiery furnace, for example. But there is, the curious thing is, we even have people around the table sharing bread, and in some instances, women doing that. But we don't have a crucified Jesus. We don't have Jesus carrying his cross or anything like that. Nothing. So it's a very curious thing that in terms of iconography, it's not there. Now, some people would say, well, we do have maybe a cross, but it's not altogether clear whether it's meant to be a cross or some other type of symbol. But there's no figure on the cross.
That could have, obviously, I guess, significance, the empty cross. in light of the resurrection or whatnot. But minimally, what can be said with confidence is that there is a surprising dearth of imagery that we have inherited depicting the death of Jesus, at least prior to minimally the 5th century. But probably even there, the depictions are still relatively scarce. Until what point? You showed some Renaissance stuff, but it seems that it becomes current prior to that.
6th, 7th century, we get stuff. But even there, there's an Irish one where it's a curious thing of this Jesus, perhaps on a cross, but surrounded by these Celtic whirls and angels. I mean, it is not a horrible thing, you know. And then we get in the 10th and 12th centuries, we get images of Jesus on the cross. He's fully clothed and looks like in complete control. So that it's not until the Black Death that you begin to get this body of Jesus in excruciating ways. And there's a Dutch piece, which is just awful. It's awful. But if you've just been through the Black Death, it really speaks to it. Yeah. But let's go back to the 1st century, because it raises questions about how do the early Jesus followers think of the death of Jesus? Now, the Romans, by crucifying Jesus, the Romans are sending a signal, such a traumatic signal, that what they're trying to do is to make sure that the followers of Jesus don't even want to think about him. They want to erase him. They want to make it so horrible that you don't. Well, we find some interesting responses to that. Basically, we can say this, that the Romans failed because the early Jesus followers remembered Jesus. That is crucial. And they remembered him in different ways. Some of them remembered him because of his wise sayings. They took him as a wisdom teacher. We see this in the Q Gospel. We see this in Thomas. We also see this in the early levels of the Didache. And these are all, Q is in the 40s and 50s. Thomas is around 70. The Didache, some of the earliest material will be in the 70s to the end of the 1st century. So we have some communities who are emphasizing that. But we do have, and this is in Paul, and his letters are between 45 and 55, we have in Paul some indication that Jesus, in fact, was crucified, which is a big one, is that he died and that God had raised him up. But we don't have in Paul any description of his death. Nothing. We do have language, however, that suggests that Paul got it from someplace. And I think it's Syria, where there were a combination of communities of Jews and Gentiles. And in Syria, it seems that these are the people who began to do a number of things. Number one, they were going to deal with the death of Jesus. And how did they do that? They dealt with it through a meal. They remembered the death of Jesus through what we call a memorial meal. I'll say a little bit more in a minute, but they also began to do what? They also began to use language of what we would call heroes. They will say, he died for us. And that for us, a lot of people say, well, of course, Jesus died for us because that's what he thought he was going to do. The way I would read it is that is an after-the-fact entitlement. In other words, people are trying to make sense of his death, and they're saying that he died for us. And the reason for that is that the Jews already, with their tradition of martyrs from the 2nd century before the Common Era, had already begun turning Jews who died under persecution. They took their catastrophic deaths and they said, aha, these people died for the people. These people died for the law. These people died for God. And in 2nd Maccabees and in 4th Maccabees, particularly in 4th Maccabees, that language is there. Even the death then is turned into a metaphor as a sacrifice. So they're literally taking disasters and turning them around. Okay, so that kind of language is now being applied to the death of Jesus. In addition, people in Syria, at Antioch probably, are doing what? They are now remembering Jesus in a meal. And this is not an unusual thing. In the ancient world, one of the things you did in remembering the dead was to have a meal, not only in that person's name, but in having the meal, you believed that that person was present. There would be a seat or a space to be taken by the dead person. And we actually have carvings of such meals. These are called meals of memorial. And the so-called Last Supper scene is actually a construction for people to remember the death of Jesus that way. And they did that. And Paul brings that custom in his work. He cites this in 1 Corinthians. So that kind of gathering, they not only gathered to pray and to give thanks to God, but they ate and they drank, and in some instances, in remembering the death of Jesus, they were basically saying that he is in fact somehow present to them. Interestingly, the material on the death meal doesn't mention resurrection. It's very interesting. If you look closely in 1 Corinthians, it doesn't mention resurrection. They do hold that he was raised by God, but the meal itself is focused on the death. So what does that mean? It means that by the time of Paul, there were some communities who were literally turning the catastrophe of the death of Jesus into something positive, something that they could not only commemorate, but get sustenance from. And so that's what was happening with Paul. But interestingly, there's no narrative of the death of Jesus. When does that happen? Well, this is where the Gospel of Mark comes in. Now, there are about two or three people in North America who care about this little gospel, the Gospel of Peter. I happen to be one of them. And But seriously, the Gospel of Peter was discovered in 1897, 98 in Egypt. And it's just a fragment. And it's nothing but a passion narrative with post-mortem visions. It's only 62 verses. And Dominic Crossan and I independently argue that a portion of that is actually earlier, and that it has a certain compositional structure. And that's the structure of the tale of the suffering innocent one. But one doesn't have to buy that, because you also see it in the Gospel of Mark. My contention would be that it started with Peter, and Mark picks it up. But if you don't buy Peter, then it starts with Mark. In any event, that's where we get the question of format. Now, what do I mean by that? The majority of people in the ancient world are illiterate, about 85%. How do they survive? They survive through memory and sound. They survive through story and passing on stories. They survive through words of wisdom, testing those words of wisdom. And one of the things that New Testament scholars have to do is to recognize that when you go into an ancient text, you're going into a foreign land. It's a different world, a different atmosphere, and you cannot presume to think that you know exactly what they mean, especially if you simply see it through your lens. So part of the discipline of New Testament scholarship, as will any historical scholar, is to be aware that you might be wrong and that you need to see if you can pick up signals that are being sent. And for me, that means picking up indications of patterns that might surprise me, that might be different. And I look for other signals and other patterns like that elsewhere in that history. And this is what happens when you look at either the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Mark. You begin to see that the narrative of the death of Jesus has elements that go back about 200 years to the year 160 BCE. And what was happening then? Around that time, Antiochus Epiphanes IV was the Syrian overlord. And he basically was controlling the East. Couldn't control Egypt. The Seleucids had that. He failed a number of times to beat them. But he controlled Israel. He was the overlord. They were paying taxes to him. And he tried to do what he thought was great things. He wanted the Jews to change the name of their god to Zeus Hypsistos, Zeus the Most High. He suggested that they use pigs in their worship, in their cult, which, you know, the bacon's going to hit the fan on that one. And he tried a number of things. And many of the high priests went along with that. Many of the upper class went along because he was bringing in all the better things of the Hellenistic world. Better trade, a gymnasium, working out and everything. But there were some Jews who resisted it. They felt that it was a betrayal of their traditions. And what did they get for that effort? They got killed. And that raised an enormous question. The question of theodicy. If these good people were trying to keep the covenant by living life in the way they understood, they thought that if they did this, God would be keeping God's part of the covenant and be there with them. And there wasn't any appearance of God. So that caused some of the scribes to try to make sense out of this. And one of the ways in which they made some sense was to start what we now call apocalyptic literature. The book of Daniel, for example, is an example of that, where they are trying to see that there would be a breakthrough. There will be a time when things will be right, and God will be just, and things will be settled. So that was one thing they could do. Revolt, of course, was done by the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees. They revolted. But the scribes not only produced apocalyptic literature, they also produced the story of the suffering innocent one. And you find portions of that already in the book of Daniel. The story of the three young men and the fiery furnace. Here we have three Jews who are charged with something they didn't do. They judged incorrectly. They're thrown into this furnace and they don't die. And then the next day, you know, the king comes and sees they're not dead and throws the bad guys in. So here you have innocent people who suffer and who are finally vindicated. There's also a story of, I think it's Susanna. It doesn't have to be males. Susanna is a young girl, and it's set in Babylon during the captivity. And there are two old men, and they must be at least 40, who have their sights on this girl, and she must be 13, 14. And they see that she comes into a garden every day, and they approach her and proposition her, and she says, "I'm not that kind of a girl." And they said, "Well, if you don't, we're going to say you did, and you will die." And she starts yelling, and they start yelling. And immediately the elders came, and they hear what the men have to say, and because there are two men, there's two witnesses, she's condemned. But before she's taken out to be stoned, Daniel appears from another book. He comes into this story, and he says, "Excuse me, could you let me examine each man individually by himself?" And he does, and then he says, "Under what tree did you see her doing this?" And since it was a god, and the guy should know. And of course, they don't corroborate their trees, and they're found in their lie, and they are brought out. So here is the story of, again, of an innocent person undergoing a trial, but vindicated before death. And then we have the wisdom of Solomon, written anywhere from, say, 50 before the Common Era to, well, maybe even 20 of the Common Era. They're dating side. But in the second chapter of the Wisdom of Solomon, we have this figure who's simply called a good person, a son of God, who is just a good man, and people don't like him. So much so that they make sure they get him killed. All right. There's, again, an innocent person who suffers. But in the fifth chapter, he reappears. But where is he? He's in the presence of God. And the people who kill him appear before God, and then they're poofed out of existence. So here we have an example of somebody who undergoes trial. He's innocent and yet condemned. This one gets killed and yet is vindicated ultimately. So the story is that pattern of an innocent person undergoes an ordeal, is condemned,
and the story of Joseph and his brothers, does that not also fit that pattern?
Yeah, it does. But well, that's an older story, though.
I know. So, yeah. But that goes even further back. Well, I don't know. I don't know the dating of those texts, but it's present in the tradition as a frame.
And the thing is, if you George Nicholsberg wrote a dissertation that was published. And I remember getting it. It was published in 73. I started my doctoral work in 74. And there was the book. And it's called Resurrection and Immortality in Intertestamental Judaism. One of the worst titles ever created. And I typed it up 17 times for one of my books. And this is before computer, of course. And I resented that title. But what Nicholsberg did was he surveyed all the literature of the intertestamental period. And he went through every single text, and he gave a taxonomy of that story pattern. So there are specific elements that are right there. Okay, what does that mean? It means that Jewish scribes are very familiar with that kind of story. Okay. Now, why do I bring all that up? Because if you're looking around, you're trying to say, why was the story told this way? Why, for example, is the Gospel of Mark's Passion narrative written that way? Many people simply say, well, of course it's written that way because that's how it happened. But actually, none of the Gospel writers were eyewitnesses to the death of Jesus. The names of the Gospels are given to these texts in the second and third centuries. Basically, what you have in each gospel is a later fabrication of earlier source materials. So we can't assume that the gospels are giving us a blow-by-blow account. This is where the texture becomes important. This is where we have to become imaginative CSIs. You know, for example, if I'm at a crime scene and I lift a fingerprint, I don't put that in a test tube, right? Because you can't get anything out of it. But if it's blood and I can put that in a test tube, I can do all sorts of things. And those you have to have an appropriate feel for the kind of evidence. That's what I mean by texture. You got to have feel for what's going on. So when you read the story of the Gospel of Mark, and you get into the passion, one of the things to do is to say, okay, let me feel through it. What's the shape? Where does this come from? And when you do that, and you break up the scenes, and you begin to see, oh my God, this looks like the pattern of the suffering innocent one. Now, there's another angle to this, and that is the question of memory. Ancient memory is crucial. As I said earlier, 85% of the population are illiterate, but it doesn't make them stupid. It makes them shrewd. They have ways of remembering because they create patterns. So if something is going to survive, it has to be remembered. And for something to be remembered, there has to be a pattern. Okay, so here I am looking at this and I'm saying, what is the pattern here? And the pattern is this pattern of the suffering innocent one. What does that mean? It means that the writer of Mark has already connected the death of Jesus with the story pattern of the suffering innocent one, which means what? That he regards Jesus as innocent. And if you tell the story this way, he's also saying something about the vindication. And that would be, of course, resurrection. In other words, one of the ingredients in the Gospel of Mark is not only is the writer coming out of a Jewish tradition, but he's also saying that Jesus's death as a suffering innocent one is somebody who dies in solidarity with all those others. And that is very meaningful for the community of Mark because that text is written not long after the fall of the Temple of Jerusalem and the defeat by the Romans. Many of the followers of Jesus in Mark's community may have experienced the war or some of the traumas of the war, and many scholars put that community either in Galilee or in Syria, which is next door, just to the northeast. In any event, what we have here then is a text which is looking at the death of Jesus, but they're not looking, they don't have historical imaginations. Nobody in the first century has a sense of time and place that we have today. The things that come from the past, they bring forward, and if they are going to be meaningful, they make them meaningful for themselves right then and there. So, why would they tell the story of the death of Jesus? They tell the story of the death of Jesus because in Mark's community, they believe that they were the last generation, that the death of Jesus and the fall of the temple were signals of the end time. And they were going to live out and see the end. But in the meantime, there were people who were suffering and there were people who were dying. And so, why do you create the death story of Jesus? To give us the facts? Well, first of all, they're not thinking of us because they never thought that we would be here. They are telling the story to throw meaningful light upon the deaths of their brethren. In other words, their death gets meaning from Jesus's death, and Jesus' death is connected to their death. It's a death of in solidarity. There's even a portion in Mark which says, just as John preached and was delivered up, Jesus preached and was delivered up. And then it says, and so you fill in the blanks. But so that's what's going on. When they tell the story, and it would be an oral performance of the death of Jesus, they would identify with this one, and they would see themselves in league with the innocents, and also therefore awaiting justification, awaiting the acknowledgement of God. Yeah. Now, what happens? Well, the writer of Mark has taken images, you might say, there were also some scriptural citations. Mark is filled with scriptural citations in the. This is a Jewish thing too. And what has Mark done? He's put it together in this larger frame. Matthew takes over Mark. Now, this is the interesting thing. Matthew's story is not the same as Mark's. Matthew adds a number of scenes, four or five different scenes. And you say, okay, well, wait a minute. Does that mean Matthew was an eyewitness? He's filling it in? Until you ask yourself, what kind of scenes are they? And every scene that Matthew adds is another instance of the suffering righteous scenes. In other words, Matthew intuitively knew that Mark was telling that kind of a story, and then Matthew continues it, but adds his own emphasis. Luke does the same thing, and John does the same thing. They all do it differently. Let me put it another way. In the ancient world, memory was rhetorical. What do I mean by that? You not only remembered in order to survive, you remembered in certain ways. And that's why format is so important. What Mark does is to take brief scriptural citations and brief allusions to the death of Jesus and puts them together in this larger structure, creates the overriding structure. And that becomes the memory frame out of which you can tell the story of the death of Jesus. So Matthew will use that frame, but also add new nuances. And Luke does the same thing, but differently. And John also does it differently, but they all know the same frame. Yeah. Now, what does that mean? It means that you can't go... Bill O'Reilly, for example, when he did a book on, I think it was Killing Jesus a few years ago, he did one on Killing Kennedy, et cetera, et cetera. He did what many people do. They ransack the Gospels as if they're treasuries of facts. And he just takes one thing and another and puts them together in some sort of coherent fashion and present that as history. And what I would say is that is misjudging the texture, that these people are not telling stories to give you the facts. They're telling stories to give you meaning about what Jesus' death means to them. And when you retell the story, you're doing this because you're doing it in the hope that as you tell the story, you will find meaning there too. So it's not a matter of facts. It's not a matter of somebody there recording.
But it does strike that, well, there's a lot going on here, right? And we talked about this a bit the other day, right? That there are still tensions which need, I think, to be addressed about relationships amongst some of these terms. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I really, you know, you have to read any given text in an appropriate fashion. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, you're just acting in bad faith. So you could read The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. And if you're reading it as an account of some night in Poe's life, you're missing the mark. And if you don't see that, I have difficulty seeing how you don't see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This obviously obtains for the Gospels or the all that material, right? Bible. Okay. It's mm-hmm. inappropriate to read it as simply a documentation.
Right.
That being said, it doesn't seem unreasonable to hear some of the things being relayed by the Gospels as also constituting propositional claims of fact. So, in other words, we're not dealing with a scenario of mutual exclusivity. The narrative is being constructed after this pattern, this sort of archetype of the suffering innocent one.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't seem like something someone's going to resist, but I think it's possible to hear the insinuation, the implication. Insinuation might be too emotive of a term. The implication that the facticity, for better or for worse, of the passion narratives is almost a point of indifference.
Well, I think I would say this, that if someone were to ask me, what are the facts here? I'd say there are two facts. One, he died, and two, he died a Roman death. Those are the facts. Everything else is subject to serious debate because, we don't really have any witnesses. And, even Mark makes a big deal out of it. All the disciples fled. So who's recounting these things? For example, the story of the scene before Pilate, it's a very moving story. A few years ago, I was at Kroger's and they had their Easter special, the Jesus special. And this one had a 19th century painting, very dramatic painting of Jesus before Pilate. And it's taken from the side, so you see Pilate and Jesus sort of from the rear, and then you see the crowd, and it's very dramatic. And I was thinking about how misleading that magazine was, because National Geographic is well known for its incredible photographs, as they the wildlife and the maps are so accurate and things like that. And I went through the whole magazine while I was in Kroger's, and I realized, number one, they didn't even tell us who put it together. And I had to go looking for the editor, who happened to be a photographer who had no background whatsoever in history or theology. And he was the one who assembled everything. And it basically gave you the impression that he could create a nice little story of the history of Jesus and his death. And because it's in the National Geographic, one might think, well, maybe there's some truth to that. There's some facticity. Well, frankly, the guy made it out of thin air. And he also made it out of traditional constructions. And he was basically playing to the assumptions of his audience. But let me get back to the trial before Pilate. This is a very interesting thing because, number one, Jesus was not a Roman citizen. He had no right to a trial. Okay? Number two, Pilate was notorious. What we know from both Jewish and Roman history is that Pilate was an ass. I mean, he came in the face of the Jews. He did things to provoke them. He was never somebody who would consult them. And in fact, a Roman governor asking the crowd to make a decision, it wouldn't happen. It would be a sign of weakness. So, and there's nothing in Roman or Jewish history to indicate he did that. So the question is, then why is it there? Well, it's there because it's true fiction. If you look at what the scene is doing, it's pitting one Jew against another Jew and having a crowd determine who's going to die. So in that sense, that's true. This is what Romans did all the time. But it's not necessarily the case that it happened there. Why? Because Jesus probably didn't have a trial. I mean, he wasn't worth Pilate's time. He was a fly on his elbow at best. Paula Frederickens, for example, in her book on the death of Jesus, she suggests that when Jesus had this situation in the temple, that was enough to get him dealt with, just take him away then. We actually don't know, honestly, we don't know why Jesus died. A number of people said, well, he died because he was a radical. Well, there were other radicals. And in fact, there was a guy by the name of Jesus some years later who was much more in the face, and he was considered crazy. They flogged him, but they didn't crucify him. So that it wasn't inevitable that Jesus would have to die. In other words, one has to entertain the possibility that his death was an accident. And he's caught up in a sweep, perhaps. He maybe was seen as a nuisance and just taken out. But the thinking that his death was so purposeful, that is actually due to what the Syrian Jesus followers did by saying his death was meaningful. Yeah. So it's much more, I think, horrible situation. Remember, this was an occupied country, and these people had no rights. And Pilate, he's known for the death of over 2,000 Jews. And he didn't put these people on trial, just had them killed. So what I'm getting at is that that scene is not necessarily historical, but guess what? In the story of the suffering innocent one, there has to be a trial. There has to be a judgment. It has to go against the just person. And that's what happens. In other words, I can argue that this scene is a necessary element in the story pattern. I can't argue it that it's necessary historically.
Nothing is necessary historically, right? Well, more or less.
You can do this to every single scene. That's the interesting thing. And Ray Brown, in his two volumes on the death of Jesus, I spent a lot of time going over what he was saying. And Ray Brown is what we call a redaction critic. He's very good at the format, as it was written by Matthew or Luke or something like that. Interesting and good description. But what he never does is to actually say that this scene actually happened. The best he would say when he would go to an individual scene is, it's possible. It's possible. But he didn't have the lens of the format of the suffering innocent story. He just takes this as a narrative and with the possibility that it might reflect something.
Speaking personally, a few things occur. Mm-hmm. One being, let's say, with reference to the question of the suffering, the story, the tale of the suffering innocent one, that you're locating is something which is in fact sort of present in the tradition of the Jewish peoples, especially at least from what, like the mid second century forward, second century BCE. All right. Probably further back even, but one thing that occurs to me is that it's not something that is exclusively a Jewish narrative. Maybe I'm a victim of my own historical conditioning here, but it seems like a motif that is fundamental to the human situation after a fashion that is not bounded to a specific culture. I don't know, but I suspect you can likely find a similar telling in other traditions.
But you'd have to have certain factors. For example, the story is told out of the concern for the apparent lack of justice. So you're not just talking about a horrible death.
Right.
You're also thinking that, wait a minute, where is God in this? Okay. So, for example, the death of Socrates. The death of Socrates was well known as a story that was told again and again. So here was the death of a hero. And there's your point right there, Tom. I would agree. These stories, remember, the second century BC is a Hellenistic age. This is where they begin. We have stories of the heroic Roman general, the heroic Greek, things like that, who will die, and they die for a cause. Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose you could contrast it with elements of the Homeric epic, where you don't really have that preoccupation with justice. That's a strong claim I just made. So I'm not holding it in an adamantine sense,
Well,
but there's kind of a brutality to that narrative, right?
look at Patroclus. I mean, he goes out and Achilles' arm and gets his head handed to him, and he gets put his legs onto the chariot and they drive him around the dust. And the best that's going to happen is the reckon. Well, Priam bringing back the body to Achilles. In some ways, there's no justice there. There's no sense. Certainly, there's no sense that the gods are just. What we do see in the Iliad is that the gods will abandon you at death. Yeah, I mean that's. Think of Hector. Hector is going out to fight Achilles, and he thinks he's accompanied by a goddess, and everything is looking good, and something happens, and he looks around, and there is Athena beating a retreat. And he knows he's a dead man, That's not justice. That's fate. Yeah. But
Now,
Socrates is different. The death of Socrates, he's dying for something. And in some ways, the remembrance of his death is a way in which they vindicate him. Yeah.
he, like Jesus, chooses his death. He could have the construction of the narrative, right? So
Well,
the followers encourage him to. They give him an escape and so forth, and he could have gotten out of Athens or whatever, but he chose to accept the judgment of the assembly. And there are reasons for that. And in the dialogues, justice stands as a the dialogues of Plato, the justice stands as a central concern, which gives rise to some rather dark speculations on the part of Plato himself. Justice, I guess, then what happens? What is the differential? What is the differential
Yeah.
between justice as it's
Well,
beginning to receive articulation from the Hellenic aspect of the Western tradition as opposed to the Judeo and subsequent
and
Judeo-Christian?
I think the Jewish angle is crucial because and this goes all the way back to the story of the burning bush. Moses comes upon this thing that he's intrigued by. It's burning, but it's not consumed. And he hears his name, and then he's told to take off his sandals. He's stripping on holy ground. But that's not the real surprising thing. The most surprising part of that story is it reveals a God who remembers slaves. And in the ancient world, if you're a slave, that means you're already forgotten by the gods. So that there is, I think, within the, you might say, some of the more ancient memories of Israel, a notion of a God who has care for the no one. And that kind of thinking, I think, is what is behind the generative aspect of the suffering innocent one. That these innocent ones, they don't have anybody. I mean, it looks like it's literally all going to hell. And the conviction out of which the stories are told is that somehow the God of Israel will be faithful. Despite appearances. And
So this, I want to connect. I want to ask about this as a point of connection. As you mentioned, this is a book that was formative to you. You say McKiernan, is that the name? But the no, it's not McKiernan. What was it? It was the Resurrection and Immortality in
oh yeah,
Intertestamental Judaism.
yeah, that's
What's the name?
yeah.
What was the guy's name again?
Always the same. It'll come to me. Nicholsburg, George.
Nicholsburg, sorry, yeah. So Nicholsburg is providing an account of resurrection as it is described within the Judaic tradition.
No, well, he links the story of the suffering righteous one with resurrection in itself. was something new in Judaism. It comes in at this time because they're dealing with the fact that people are dying and God's not there, and why keep the covenant? And so resurrection comes in. This is the first time the Jews begin to think seriously about that. Well, what does resurrection mean? It means that at some point in the future, God will provide justice and the dead will stand again. They will be created again. And there are different stories, and each story is different. You know, in some stories, the whole world is recreated. In other stories, the world is the same, but people are recreated to live again. When Paul talks about resurrection, he's talking about being resurrected into a heavenly body. So there are a variety of ways in which they're all trying to say that God will be just, and not just an abstract justice, but just to these people who were so wronged. Yeah, there is that relationality there that you don't find in some other texts. Yeah.
Yeah. This transposes to a question of, you know, what is the locus of the real?
Yeah.
That might seem like I'm making a few jumps to say, well, what does this have to do with reality? What I mean by that is that all sounds really great, but what is it? I think it's like the last line of, it's one of Hemingway's, I can't remember which book it was, but the last, and I think it's The Sun Also Rises, but I could be wrong. Mm. And it's, isn't that a nice story?
Mm.
And there's a kind of, you know, snideness to right. that. Like, right. okay. And what I want to resist is the notion that this understanding of redemption, maybe I want to use, that's a tricky word, but I think it's clear enough what I mean by that in this context, right? That this approach to perceived injustice, mm-hmm. how does one resist the idea that you just don't want to confront the brutality of the universe? So you're painting a picture, but that picture, what keeps someone from understanding it as being ultimately fraudulent? That's why I'm asking the question of the real, which isn't a pleasant question.
I think you're really hitting the nub of it, because that's what they were trying to do in the second century before the Common Era. They were dealing with what is reality. And the response that these scribes were making was they were writing out of the conviction that this God is trustworthy. And I'm not trying to avoid things. I'm trying to say that, and the same thing you can say with the writer of Mark and Peter, when they write this narrative, they're not writing it to sugarcoat or cover over. No, they take seriously the fact that this person has become God-forsaken. And they're saying, we can take that hit and we can still tell the story. I'm going to tell it this way because we're telling it out of a conviction that there is more to come. There is, and this more to come is not just a pipe dream. They're saying this, that this is where the real is going. And another way of saying this is that if that's all there was, then they don't have the ability to tell the story. That the ability to tell the story is given to them out of that hope that this is the way reality works. Yeah. So another way of saying it is that when you ask where the real is, the real is really working out of the future.
So here,
and it's touching them right then and there.
Right, the futurity, and then, I mean, we could visit the notion of the kingdom of God and its at handness in this connection. But before turning to that, I feel compelled to ask then, with reference to the question of the resurrection of Jesus, right? So there is the claim that this person died and that then he is, he resumes his life. He is resurrected on the third day. I don't think it's going to be satisfying to understand that claim as one which is merely true fiction. It seems that for the predominant majority of Christianity, or for Christians and the early Jesus believers, there was the understanding that this happened in terms of bare fact. And I hope I don't seem like I'm being antagonistic.
No.
But see, I think it's an important question.
But when I mentioned the phrase true fiction, I meant that in regard to the story of Pilate's trial.
Yes, right. Not right? With reference to that.
I'm not saying
so
that this story, the whole pattern of the story, is simply a fiction. It is a fiction. That is a fiction. But it's a construction based upon what? A conviction that they consider to be quite real. And the reality is really the nature of that God. Yeah.
So what does the notion of the risen Jesus mean in that light?
Well, see, this is very interesting, because if we look at it historically in terms of the different ways they talk about it, resurrection can mean different things. What it doesn't mean is resuscitation. You're not going to come back the same way. That's the interesting thing. I mean, for example, you know, we can use the old caterpillar. The caterpillar changes.
Okay.
It doesn't become a caterpillar.
You know, actually,
there's a real change.
It's a transfiguration, as it were.
Well, yeah, there's something going on. In other words, we're talking about metamorphosis. For example, when Paul talks about resurrection, he literally is talking, if you want it by literal, he is saying that you will become a star, you will become a moon, you'll become a meteor. Because they thought in those days that those planets and were intelligences. Philo of Alexandria says that the planets are nous, they're minds. They're not matter at all. You know, Galileo screwed everything up by saying, well, the stuff on the moon and the stuff under my shoe, the same thing. And what Galileo lost was the mind. That the ancients thought these were minds. So that when Paul talks to the Corinthians and he says, you know, you're not fully resurrected. The life begins, the lasting life begins now, but the transformation is going to be beyond your telling. I mean, that's what he's thinking. And that's an interesting thing. One of the problems that we have is that we look at the post-mortem stories of Jesus and we think it's resuscitation, but those stories are sort of like ghost stories in the sense that they're meant to have holes in them. They're meant to signal that it's not exactly the same thing.
Well, I would resist that characterization, ghost. I don't like that phrase, ghost story.
Well, in one of the texts it says, look, I'm not a ghost, right?
Right.
But he goes through walls. In other words, the ancients did already have, you know, communication with the dead. They ate with the dead and things like that. So what these stories are trying to say in some ways very limited way. It's something that Paul would never say, because Paul would say, well, no, you're not going to be like that. So what they do, they tend to be much more realistic in the Roman sense of the word realism. And it gives people the impression today that from death to life is a continuum, nothing, but no, there's a significant change. And you're not in the same time and space. You're changing dimensions, all sorts of things. But they don't even have the word. Not a we, actually.
Well, I think that you can have the notion of a different order of time, where we could talk about the temporal, whether kairotically, and then kairos, as opposed to.
You know, when Aquinas talks about that God is always present.
Right.
There's no future. There's no past in God from Aquinas' point of view. And that is something that we cannot handle.
Then with reference to futurity, is it really futurity, which is the space wherein one encounters this transformation? Or is that just an aspect of the temporal which links to the kairotic and transcends it?
Well, I think what we have to say is that no matter what words we use, they're metaphorical. Even future would be metaphorical. That words will fail you. But words failing doesn't mean you can't use words and not trying. But knowing, you also know at the same time that if it's real, it's going to be more than this. Yeah.
I have to say, as you were saying, it came to my mind earlier when you were talking about the butterfly, the caterpillar to the butterfly, but a contemporary story or tale where I suddenly realized has something of this in it is the Lord of the Rings saga. Mm-hmm. And the transformation of Gandalf, right?
Yeah.
Where he, has to confront the Balrog and goes to death, and he rises, and then he's no longer Gandalf the Grey, but Gandalf the White.
Yeah.
Who vaguely, his only almost a vague memory of himself is Gandalf the Grey. Mm-hmm. And sort of stands as this, there's some as powerful and as significant as Gandalf the Grey was, something had happened where he was, as it were, reconfigured.
Yeah.
And so that may be a pointer to the sort of thing at which we're gesturing here. That's a remarkable narrative there. Of course, Tolkien himself was a Christian. So then I guess to cycle back then, right, your book then, Inventing the Passion, is aiming to excavate clues that will awaken us to the fact that these narratives cannot be read correctly if we're reading them in the register of our ordinary sense of time. Would you say that's...
Yeah, if you're reading these texts, just simply find out what happened. You know, with a, you might say, a modern reporter's nose, what went away. Then we're really missing, I think, very significant clues. First of all, these texts were not written for us. They were written for their communities, and they were trying to be meaningful for these. They were trying to deliver meaning for these communities. We are interlopers. We are looking over their shoulders. And, it's like... if you were watching I remember taking a girl to an American football game who had never been to an American football game. And she kept on saying, why are they always stopping? Why don't they keep on moving around? Because for her, football was soccer. And mm-hmm. The whole experience was not enjoyable to her because she just could not comprehend it. She thought it was a very silly game. And I thought, I was there with another guy and his girlfriend, and he was an all-American football player at Princeton. And he was looking at my girlfriend at the time as if she was from out of space, you know. And I had so much fun watching the reaction. He just couldn't believe it. And this guy ate and drank football. He was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys and he decided not to do it. But and I actually played football with him, tag football. I caught one of his passes, 50-yard pass. It just came to me. It was a wonderful experience. But she could not understand why we were excited, or was particularly why he was excited. She was just reading it differently. And when we look at these texts and we read them simply to mine what we want to get out of them, we're missing a lot. For example, I've had a number of pastors and priests and ministers ask me, well, what am I going to do on Sunday, on Passion Sunday, when we have this long gospel? Should we preach? And I say, yes, you should preach. And he said, well, it's so long. I said, you don't have to say anything. All you have to do at the beginning of the service is simply say, how many of you have had the experience of noticing an innocent person die? Somebody who was maybe young, somebody who should not have died, and you cried out, how is this possible? Where is God? If you've had that experience, remember it as you're listening to the story. And if you do that, then you will really understand the mechanism, the imaginative mechanism of the story. It's a story about the innocent sufferer. And for Mark's community, Jesus is in solidarity with all those innocent ones. So Jesus' death is not unique and alone. It's not all on Jesus, but in fact, it's a recognition that this sufferer is in fact in the hands of God. And that's a very different way of reading it. You're not reading it to feel guilty. You're not reading it to browbeat people. And it has been used that way. So some people have come to church, for example, in Poland and various other parts of Middle Europe, and the priest would preach and lay the blame, and the blame was on Jews, and people would leave their service. They would go to the Jewish neighborhoods, and they would burn synagogues and kill and rape. And these pogroms happened again and again. And that's a complete misuse of that narrative. But we also do that individually. We sometimes use these stories to, in fact, inflict punishment on ourselves, when in fact, the story is not trying to inflict pain. It's trying to say that indeed, you're not alone in it. And that's a big difference. It's a real big difference. And again, you might say, well, how is that possible? Well, again, this is not a factual thing. It's a matter of conviction. Do you trust that reality ultimately is there for you or not? And that is the angle out of which these stories are told. So, in other words, my detection of that framework, that fabric, that context, that texture is not simply to throw a smoke screen up, but rather to open up the possibility of where they find meaning and why it's meaningful. Not to take the story away, but in fact to make the story applicable, but you have to do some moves. So you have to take some moves.
Right. It's you're what the story is doing is putting you in contact with a deeper reality than that which is phenomenal. The phenomenal as opposed to the noumenal. I feel like we could almost wrap it there, but a lingering question is, what is happening with, now that this is the sort of question that can be answered in that short of a compass, but what is happening then which distinguishes the early Jesus movement, which becomes Christianity, from the Judaic tradition out of which it grows. What happens that differentiates that? What is the innovation, as it were?
I'm not sure what you mean. Are we talking about the separation of the Jesus groups from the matrix, Jewish matrix? What are we talking about? Are you saying that?
I guess what I'm asking is, does the person of Jesus merit, or maybe it's a mistake, being given a sort of ontological privilege? The understanding of Jesus as God, is that what differentiates Christianity from Judaism? And then I suppose what would be the, it seems that something happens with the early Jesus believers that separates them from their Jewish antecedents and contemporaries. What is that? Maybe that's a more basic question. Is it?
Well, I must say I've been asking that question for many, many years, and there is no simple answer because we do not know when the break occurred. That it, in all likelihood, because we. In the fourth century, the third and fourth century, they were still burying Jewish Jesus believers and Jews in the same burial ground. You know, and if they were separated, they wouldn't do that. But at the same time, you have Chrysostom railing against Judaizers. Don't you go to the synagogues. Don't you dare go. But they were going, you know. So something is happening. We know that, for example, when Christianity becomes the official religion, at the same time, they begin to denigrate Judaism. Laws are now in force against Jews. Jews cannot do this. They cannot own slaves, which means they can't farm. There are various things that happen in the late 4th century, early 5th century, that begin to distinguish Jesus followers from, and now Christians from, Jews. But that's later, and you know, one could, and I don't think it's, is Jesus God and all that. I don't see, Jesus himself never worried about that. He was interested in the empire of God, you know, and one of the things he might have said is, you know, why do you call me good? You know, so I don't see the historical Jesus being hung up on that. Later people will be, because the entitlement gives them entitlement, and it's becomes a matter of status and things like that. But you know, the early Jesus believers had to deal with the fact that this guy who is traveling around, this itinerant poet preacher, you know, didn't have a place to lay his head, in one sense. And relied on the kindness of strangers, a healer who, you know, extended and risked things. I mean, this is a curious person. But then when you make him special, are we making him special in the wrong way? You know, I did a paper on difference in the ancient world. What does it mean to be different? And you know, in many respects, people felt that they were in constant competition with one another. Your being different meant that you have favors of the gods. And if you didn't have the favors of the god, you're not going to survive. But the more favor from the gods, the more different you are. Well, that rested upon this competitive notion. And that competitive notion is based upon I win at another's expense. And that, I don't think, is what Jesus was about. Because the interesting thing is you know, if he's crucified, it means that Rome won at his expense. He's been rendered nothing. But Paul's insight was that the one who is God forsaken is the one God selects. God continues to have favor upon the one whom everybody else, including Paul, before he has this breakthrough, considers God forsaken, who doesn't have an advantage. And the irony is that by the fourth and fifth century, you have Jesus believers, Christians, who are playing the advantage card. And that, to me, causes me to worry that when we play the advantage game, that we are basically playing the Roman imperial game. Yeah.
Yes, because, yeah, so.
So
it,
I mean,
is really a betrayal then.
Really, really good questions. These are extremely profound. And I think these are questions that people are not asking. And because they're not asking these questions, I think the people begin to fear. Because if we are playing a game of advantage, then we're all screwed. We really are. It's a matter of who, you know, but see, you don't have to play that game. That doesn't mean that if you don't play that game, you're always going to succeed. No, because you're still trying to play the game of, you know, winning. But yeah.
Well, yeah. You. It's a sticky wicket. If you really opt out of the game in a radical way, I do think you have to realize this is going to entail some serious inconveniences in your life.
But it also could mean that you're going to be surprised too. I mean, it's not. It's all
not mutually, yeah, it's mysterious. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these other things shall be added unto you.
Yeah.
But how that happens, that's far more curious, far more mysterious than, you know.
Yeah. But I think this is getting back to the historical Jesus. I mean, when Jesus is talking about the kingdom, he's talking about the effective presence of God. And he actually is living in the conviction that God is effectively present. And so, you know, there's good news and bad news. The good news is God is effectively present. The bad news is God is effectively present. Sit with that for a while. Because it doesn't seem to change anything. You know, it doesn't until it dawns on you what it might mean. Yeah. I mean, I think that's very important. And that's why I, you know, very much appreciate the wisdom tradition of Jesus. Because it forces you to come to grips with that. Yeah. You know, in some ways, I mean, take a page out of the Zen booklet, you know, first there are mountains, then there are no mountains, then there are mountains again. Well, if you think about God's effective presence, you know, when Jesus said, "Congratulations, you poor, God's empire belongs to you," the poor are looking around saying, "Where? Where?" You know? But what happens when he eats with anybody instead of following the way he should have? You know, what happens if he takes seriously people who are nobodies? And it changes people. Yeah. And the irony, of course, is when I think of this, I think of Matthew 25, you know, where were you, you know, and all that. And one of the things that in the Catholic tradition that was done is they turn all those things into corporal works of mercy. So you do all the following. But the whole scene works because you did what you didn't know what you're doing. You know, where did he see you? Where did he? Yeah. And it seems completely unfair that people are, you know, shepherded away as goats, but what's going on is those actions in the first century where you would be considered wasting your time. You don't go to the people who are in jail. You don't do that because that would be in the first century considered a waste of time. So the thing is, if you really want to get a sense of that passage, which is not from the historical Jesus, but from Matthew, they're saying that if you really want to know what are the important things to do, is you give yourself away. You expend yourself on what your world thinks is a waste of time. And if you think about it, if you think about how we survive quite a lot because people went out of their way to waste their time on us. You know, I think of my mother. I was 2 months premature. I came home, and the priest didn't tell my mother, but I came home from my happy death. And she nursed me with an eyedropper. And every 15 minutes, I don't know how she did it. It was, you know, I was there, but I was oblivious. But by Christmas, I was brought home in June. By Christmas, she was delighted in saying I was a fat little Buddha because I had survived. And it was only after that that the priest said, oh, yeah, I went to the good nuns, and they were all praying for your son's happy death. And she said, if I had known that, I would have scratched his eyes out. But what I'm getting at is we all have in our lives those people who have done something that they might have even forgotten they've done. But without it, we wouldn't be here. And it's that, I think, those lost moments, which in fact might be the most meaningful. You know, I've seen this as a teacher. Somebody who comes up to you 10 years later and say, you know, you said something in class once. What was it? And they will say, and I say, I don't remember it. I honestly don't. But it hit them at the right time. And it was important that they hear it. And they can carry on. But you know, this is part of what the deep mystery is. Yeah.
It's deep, and it's actually truly awesome in the old, the original sense of that word.
Yes.
You really contemplate that. It's not comfortable. At least it's not comfortable for me. So,
well, it's not comfortable for most of us. But you know, that's the experience of the holy. The holy is both fearful and fascinating. You know, you shouldn't be comfortable. That means you're alive, though. You know, when we're truly comfortable, we're probably comatose. Yeah.
You know, we should probably wrap it up here.
Okay, I just want to say one more thing.
Please go on.
Well, it's just that one way of describing the resurrection of Jesus is that Jesus was surprised.
So, yes. Well, we'll leave it there. I should say that, but we should just leave it there. But I'm not going to be naughty and just add that what really then is raised is a sequel question, and maybe we could talk about this in another conversation. Is the question of power? It's a question of power, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
because
more
when you live like that, but you just give things away, when you become a fool in the world, the powerful do not like that.
No, they don't.
One little bit.
No, but you know, that's the essence of good comedy. The powerful do not like to laugh. No, and you know, why are there so many good Jewish comedians? You know, you know, Jesus was the first of the Jewish. You know that.
I never thought about it specifically, but yeah.
But Jesus has more in line with Seinfeld than Jerry Falwell, because Jerry Falwell was just too serious and too full of himself. You know, and you know, it's yeah. It's, but power would be a good topic to spend some time on, because that, and you know, Walter Wink, the great Walter Wink, had much to say on that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. And thanks again. And everybody, you should get Dr. Dewey's book. I'll put the link, you know, in the description and all that, Inventing the Passion. And more importantly, go and do something utterly idiotic in your life. So,
Yeah, get something.
hey.
You will be surprised. You really will be.
All right. Well, have a good night.
Good night, Tom.